Welcome to Hallel Fellowship, found on the internet at hallel.info. That's hallel.info. We hope you are encouraged by the following recorded Bible study to look deeper into every word that proceeds from the mouth of God and how they were lived out in the life of Yeshua HaMashiach, often called Jesus the Christ.
Everybody. So I had spoken of last time I was here, I was going to the book of Hosea, and I was going to continue on that. However, somebody had requested before I did this a few days back to talk about a particular feature or component in the Torah portion. Now, for those who aren't aware, the Torah portion is Lech Lecha, which I'm not going to read through all of it because it's not... I'm not covering all the Torah portion. We only have about an hour. It's about, what? Can't see that clock. 120? 125? And Lech Lecha, which is Genesis chapter 12 through 17, the first 27 verses of chapter 17 of Genesis, says various things. This Torah portion, I'm not reading all of it. It is covered multiple times on our website. Regarding the different events. But of course, this is of course the calling of Abraham out of Ur of the Chaldeans and traveling down to find this land of Canaan. Of course, it discusses all the details that Lot went with him and such and how he got there. We're not discussing all those details. There's a particular component while he's there, which I was asked to talk about, some event that had happened to him and discuss this event. Now, while he was there, those of you who do not know the details or cannot remember the details of Abraham, when he left the Ur of the Chaldeans, he goes down into Canaan. This is Genesis 12 and 13. Goes down to Canaan, he builds a few altars, and he resides for a little while near Bethel. And of course, Lot is with him. But there's a famine. They go down to Egypt. Abraham goes to Egypt. This is where, you know, when he says to Sarah, tell them you're my sister. Remember that story? You're not my wife. At least they'll kill me and take you as their wife. And of course, she's taken anyway, but she's not physically used as a wife would be used by the Pharaoh. But she is set free. And of course, they go on. And Pharaoh says, why would you do this to me? Yada, yada, yada. I'm not going into details of Abraham's, what's the right word? Prejudgment of Pharaoh or the Egyptians at this time. That's for another story. But there is a section in Genesis chapter 14, which I was asked to talk about. So this is a story while Abraham returns from Egypt. He goes through and there's Lot and he separate because they have too many cattle, too many flocks and such. The herdsmen are fighting and bickering over land and space. Lot separates and goes down to the area of Sodom and Sodom and Gomorrah. Basic map. I'll draw this. I like maps. Well, make it a little bigger. Basic shape of Israel, approximately. That's not perfect. Hebron and territory are somewhere around here. Actually, a little further south. The Dead Sea, this little space here represents Dead Sea. We have Jerusalem is floating around here. We'll put J for Jerusalem, put H here for Hebron. Lot and Abraham divide. Lot looks over the Jordan Valley, which is all of this territory prior to the Dead Sea. So this is before the Dead Sea existed. This is an area which is mostly all fertile valley, fertile land, and there's Butte style pit, like little areas of marshiness where there's a lot of dead and decaying products, and which is what you'd find at the bottom of an ocean or bottom of a lake, are existing in the area. So Lot and Abraham separate. Lot goes along and hangs out at Sodom, and we don't know the precise location of Sodom. It's gone. Those remember what happened? There's a story about Sodom, Gomorrah. I've heard that term before, and Lot's wife. Yeah, Sodom doesn't exist anymore. One, guess why? Okay, big things come around, boof, fire. Yeah, Sodom's gone. So is Gomorrah. So they just guess where they're at. Some argue they're toward the top half of where the Dead Sea was. Some people say they're to the bottom half of the Dead Sea was. I don't care. It doesn't matter. They're gone, okay? They're gone. Either way, Lot hung out in that territory. And of course, the angels come and they carry Lot, say, Lot, get out of here, all that stuff. We won't go to Sodom and Gomorrah, so that's for later. But when they separated, Lot took all of his people, his product, his cattle and such. Get a little closer to you. And separate, he hung out as far north as Sodom. I'm guessing, hence, Sodom's toward the top half, but I don't know. As Sodom hung out his tents there, and of course, then there was a war. That's where Genesis chapter 14 comes in. So let's read Genesis 14 to discuss the particular event that I'm talking about today. So in Genesis 14, it says, "And it happened in the days of Aramphel, the king of Shinar, Arioch, king of Elazar, Chedorlaomer, king of Elam, and Tidal, king of Goim, that these made war on Bera, king of Sodom, Bersha, king of Gomorrah, Shinav, king of Adma, and Shimbir, king of Zeboim, and the king of Bela, which is Zoar. All these had joined the valley of Siddim, now the Salt Sea." Stop. So they all joined around the Salt Sea. So they're all fighting in this massive, what is now the Dead Sea. The time, of course, then it was not. In verse 4, 12 years they had served Chedorlaomer, and they rebelled 13th year. The 14th year, Chedorlaomer, the kings, and the kings who were with him, came and struck Rephaim at Ashtaroth Karnim, at Zuzim in Ham, the Emim at Shevat Kirathim, and the Horites in their mountains of Seir, as far as the plain of Paran, which is by the desert. Then they turned back and came to Enmishpat, which is Kadesh, and they struck all the territory, the Amalekites, and also the Amorites who dwelt in Hazazon Tamar. The king of Sodom went forth with the king of Gomorrah, the king of Adma, the king of Zeboim, the king of Bela, which is Zoar, and engaged them in battle in the valley of Siddim, with Chedorlaomer, the king of Elam, Tidal, king of Goim, Aramphel, king of Shinar, and Arioch, king of Elasar, four kings against five. The valley of Siddim was full of bitumen wells. The kings of Sodom and Gomorrah fled and fell into them, while the rest fled to mountains. They seized all the wealth of Sodom and Gomorrah and all their food, and they departed. They captured Lot and his possessions, Abram's nephew, and they left, for he was residing in Sodom. Then there came the fugitive and told Abram, the Urvi, who dwelt in the plains of Mamre, the Amorite, the brother of Eshcol and the brother of Anar, these being Abram's allies. When Abram heard that his kinsman was taken captive, he armed his disciples, who had been born in his house, 318, and he pursued them as far as Dan. And he, with his servants, deployed against them at night and struck them. He pursued them as far as Hobab, which is north Damascus. He brought back all the possessions. He also brought back his kinsman Lot with his possessions, as well as the women and the people. We'll stop there for a minute. So basically, this battle took place. One king's lost, they all ran. The territory of Dan is up here. Now, we don't know if he's referring to the territory or the city. The city of Dan didn't exist yet, but the author of our Torahs, our Bibles, knows the city of Dan exists, so it's referring to the location. And Damascus is out here, approximately. Actually, a little further north. So they travel. Abraham's hanging out in Hebron. He takes his 318, as well as the allies who are with him. Mind you, there he had friends, allies. So the 318 were from Abraham's group, and then there was an unknown number from the other men that went with him, because they were from the other two allies. So all three grouped them in together. Abraham takes 313, because it says 313 that were born in his house, while the others were born in the other houses, and we'll learn later that they take their portion of those spoils as well, the other two men that were allies with him. They all traveled north as far as Dan, and they capture or chase them out to someone this territory up here north of Damascus. So basically, they're just traveling along, and then capture them or reach them and scatter them to the east. That's the route they took, or roughly, approximately. I'm not showing the mountain terrains. It's beyond the scope of our discussion. Let's get to verse 17. The king of Sodom went out to meet him after his return from defeating Chedorlaomer and the king with him to the valley of Shaveh, which is the king's valley. But Melchizedek, king of Salem, brought out bread and wine. He was a priest of God Most High. He blessed him, saying, "Blessed is Abram of God the Most High, maker of heaven and earth, and blessed be God the Most High, who has delivered your foes into your hand." And he gave him a tenth of everything. The king of Sodom said to Abram, "Give me the people and take the possessions for yourself." Abram said to the king of Sodom, "I lift up my hand to Jehovah, God the Most High, maker of heaven and earth. If so much as a thread to a shoe strap, or if I shall take anything from yours, you shall not say it is I who made Abram rich. Far from me. Only what the young men have eaten and the share of the men who accompanied me, Aner, Eshcol, and Mamre, they will take their portion." So in this story, we obviously Abraham confirms he has his allies went with him. So what they've eaten, Abraham's men have eaten, as well as the portion divided up amongst the other three allies who went with him in this battle. They all get divided up. I was asked to cover specifically Melchizedek regarding him and the details about him. That's why I'm covering this chapter today, as opposed to going through Hosea as I had intended. So before I go into this, regarding this one section, chapter 14, not the entire Torah portion, unless you really, really need to know, any questions about what we're discovering or talking about today? Oops. Yes, Larry.
It's not really a question, but what I noticed when I was reading the Torah portion is that, you know, I've said to you several times, how come the Lord is showing me these things this late in my life? And it turns out Abraham, when he started his walk, was 75, yep. And I'm not even that old yet. So,
better late than never, right? That works. Yes, my father asks that question regularly. Why now? I'm understanding it now. I'm old. Like, yeah. Get used to it. That's how it's going to work. There's lots of stories in midrashim or stories or. Ideas about what Abraham thought and did as a young man, all that good stuff. I'm not going to talk about all those details today, or how much he did or didn't know about God and what God taught him. Any questions or comments regarding the Torah portion specifically before I get into this? Yes, Jared.
Okay, so God ends up destroying Sodom and Gomorrah, but then in this Torah portion, he sends all these armies, and it's more than they say it is, because one of the kings is nation of Goyim, which is nations, it's a much bigger army than they make it out to be, even though a seven-nation army, pretty big. Why doesn't God just have them destroy and utterly wipe out Gomorrah and Sodom and Gomorrah instead of having to...
Wait, so having to wait smite. A while longer. Yeah, we'll smite him later. Yeah, that's a good question. Because to be fair, God uses men at different times. He used Nebuchadnezzar. He uses the Assyrians in general to come and correct his people in Israel without completely destroying them. He uses them periodically. Me personally speaking, just my personal opinion, it was probably God's way of getting these men in there to take out the people. Because mind you, a king is only a king if there are people to rule over, right? What if there are no people? Are you a king? Well, maybe of yourself. But it's hard to collect taxes that way. Just being honest, it's hard to collect your own taxes if it's in your own back pocket. It doesn't work so well. And you can't build a lot of things when it's just you pushing up, you know, beams and such and hauling rocks around. So a king is not a king unless there's people to rule over. So if God took all the people of Sodom, which appears he did, then the king has nothing. Hence, when Abraham comes back, Abraham comes back, he says, "I want the people. You keep the stuff." Why? Because if you keep the people, I'm not a king anymore. But if I get the people back, I'm back to being king. I reestablish myself as a kingdom. Kings need people to rule. That makes them a king. Otherwise, they're just ordinary wanderer or a nomad or a loner hermit type of person. That's kind of how kings work. So in his instance, it appears that God would say, "All right, I'm taking all the people away." He did take the kingdoms away. But Lot was amongst them. So Abram's okay, yeah, you took the kingdom away, the kings should have learned from this, of course they don't. And of course he grabs the people back because Lot's there, he wants Lot out of there. Now if Lot had not settled there, not been part of it, it may not have happened this way. Abram would have said, oh yeah, tough luck. You're not very good people anyway, as we learn, because Abraham told Sodom, no one say you made Abram rich. And of course, you learn, Abram already knows the reputation of Sodom and Gomorrah. That's pretty well established. In the next Torah portion, when this angel's talking to Abram and they're discussing it, Abraham whittles him down from 50 to 10, right? Because Abram knows there aren't that many righteous people in that town. He's hoping Lot and maybe his family, a couple of daughters, sisters, sons, whatever, might be good enough to make the city be saved. But of course, it was not. So there was a method of which God used. It just didn't work out the way that planned out that way. Okay. This topic, when we cover today, is Melchizedek. There is lots and lots of books, opinions, papers, sermons, everything imaginable written about this particular individual, from you name it to every language there is. There are a lot of ideas, a lot of opinions on it. Personally speaking, I don't subscribe to most of them. I don't agree with most of them. That's my personal opinion. That's me, Daniel. I don't agree with most of them. That doesn't mean everybody else has to agree with me. You have your own opinion on who this guy was or wasn't. It doesn't matter to me. All I'm going to say is it's what the scripture talks about him, how it uses his terms, what it uses his words, and to the best of the scripture's limitations, what it tells you of who he was. That's all. You can jump to your own conclusions if you want to make your own conclusions about who he was or who he was not. So Melchizedek. It's a breakdown of two words, Melech and Zedek, but there's a personal identifier on the first syllable or first section. So Now we would probably recognize most of these words we get from Melech. Which we get the idea of king. And Zedek, now this is done in two different ways. I'm going to write both of them down. I'm not advocating either position. There's Sadiq, which was a Canaanite god named Sadiq. There's also the Hebrew word Zedek, which means righteous. Now, you can jump to your own conclusions which one it's referring to. Now, mind you, he is a king of a particular town. The town's name, what was the king that was the town's name? The name of Salem. Salem, actually. Which means peace. It's a derivative of the word shalom. It's an incomplete derivative because it means that shalom is spelt with a vav, and this one it drops the vav. So it's just Salem. Now, we don't officially know, he's put in quotes, what town that is, but you sort of do. If you go to the Psalms 76, go to Psalm 76, it gives you a really hard argument of what town this particular town is that he's part of. So Psalm 76, this is a psalm of David, Asaph is singing this psalm or wrote it. In Psalm 76, I'm not going to read the whole psalm. This is just part of it. The first few verses there. It says, this is a psalm of Asaph. In Judah, God is known. His name is great in Israel. In Salem also is his tabernacle, and his dwelling place is in Zion. There he broke the arrows of the bow and the shield and sword of battle, Selah. So in Asaph's psalm, which he's writing long after the establishment of Solomon's temple, the kingdom has been established, he is referring in May's course to Salem, which is the same word, is where his tabernacle, his dwelling place in Zion. Now, where did God put his tabernacle after King Solomon built the temple? I'll give you one guess. One guess. No, that was before he built the temple. After Solomon built the temple, there's one spot where God's tabernacle dwelled when Solomon built the temple. It's in the temple. He put all the stuff there. And God's presence entered it. So that was his presence he entered it. So we can learn from Psalm 76, there's only one place that Salem is referred to which is also the place where God put his tabernacle at the same time, which is in Jerusalem. All right, there's no other place that our Bibles give us. So we can learn from Psalm 76, the king of Salem, which is king of Jerusalem. Now, what's confusing is Jerusalem wasn't called Jerusalem at this time. It was called Jebus and a few other names as far as its different town names. But that's the town which he is a part of, or where he's a king of. So we have established of who the Salem is, a poetic formality, a poetic form of peace, or to be shalom, or be at peace. So, king of Jerusalem or king of Salem, same place, according to Psalm 76. Let's go back a little bit. Go back to Melchi. I'm not going to discount the interpretation of the book of Hebrews, but the word Melchizedek means my king. It's my, because there's a yod at the end of it. It means my king is righteous. That's what the words actually transliterated or translated to English mean. So Melchizedek means my king, and then is righteous. I'm going to redraw this a little further down, have more room on my board. So my king, that is Melchi, is righteous. Now, I do realize Hebrews says it is king of righteousness. As Hebrews also says, the same sentence, it is interpreted or can be interpreted to mean king of righteousness. That is an interpretation, which Hebrews says, the author saying, I am interpreting the words Melchizedek as king of righteousness. It means it's who's deciding what it is for his sake of argument. The words mean my king is righteous in Hebrew. That's what the phrase actually means. That's what it says. But, and now if it's missing the yod, it would be Melchizedek. But it's not. It has the yod. So Melchizedek. Which is my king. Okay. Let's move forward a little bit. So a little bit of addition of his name. This is an important thing because that's what we're going to study a bit about this individual. Melchizedek is, as far as your biblical texts are concerned, a real living human being. I know there are a lot of Christian groups that say, well, he was a spirit, he was Jesus, he was this, he was that. You can argue that all you want, that's fine. But the word he was treated as a human being, as a man, as a flesh and blood human being. So he is a person who is my king is righteous, as his name means. Jerusalem is where his capital is. Now, we'll talk about that later, actually. Let's.
Jerusalem used to be just Salem, and then
Jerusalem? Yes. Oh. Yes, the names have changed. Names have changed multiple times. If you look at, let's see here, in 1 Chronicles 11, Jerusalem's called Jebus. Yeah. It's also a third name. Was that? I don't recall the name meaning. It comes because the Jebusites owned it. They named it Jebus. Which, if you put Jebus and Salem together, Jebusalem, it's a lot like Jerusalem. You can see how humans would put it together as a complete name. Jebus Salem, it is Jerusalem or Jerusalem. Same idea, how you get the names would derive together. I did not look up the term or figure what the term Jebus means. I don't know. So I'll go by your word for what that means underfoot. It could be. Let's get you on here. So we have an idea of what this king is. Now, I will say to you right now, my opinion is that he is a messianic figure. Messianic figure, which is no different than, for example, Joseph. Joseph was a messianic figure, right? How do we know Joseph was a messianic figure? Any ideas why I would say Joseph was a messianic figure? Well, what did he do? What were his actions and how did he live his life? He saved a bunch of people. He saved his whole family, brought him back down to Egypt to deliver them from certain death. And of course, he did it through messianic tools. We have the symbols scattered throughout his storyline with the whole the bread and the wine, the cupbearer and the baker thing. We have those parts in there. We also have, of course, being the second only to Pharaoh in name only. He was otherwise he was virtually like Pharaoh. We have a lot of messianic symbols built into Joseph's life to indicate he was a messianic figure, not that he was the anointed Messiah for, you know, salvation of all humanity. Rather, he's a symbol of that part. So we have these parts. A shadow. So Melchizedek is also a shadow. He's an example of what we can look to, what our Messiah would look like, or at least some parts of him. I'm going to erase some of this because I don't need all of it up here, but I need more board space. So we have Melchizedek, king of Jerusalem, which means my king is righteous, or my king's righteous, city of peace, or something which is at peace. Being a messianic figure, the only tools we have to go through with Melchizedek's existence is the bread and the wine he uses, the words he tells to Abram, of course, as well as his name. So we're going to focus first on two different parts to this today. The first part, divide this up a little bit, we'll focus a little bit about his name. The messianic figure, his name is rather unusual, not completely unusual. His name is used in multiple places, different fashions, but it's a little bit uncommon. So it's a little bit about his name, first of all, because his name, of course, as we learned, is my king is righteous and king of peace. So we're looking at, if we're to look at messianic figure, focusing on his name alone, focus on those two elements. Yes, Larry, you had a comment?
I was going to say he was considered the high priest also.
Right, which high priest of whatever religion he was in charge of, that was his high priest, which is a huge component of our second portion we're talking about today.
One of the things that struck me about it is that they always talk about Abraham as being the first one who recognized Jehovah as the one God, but Melchizedek was most of them before him, so there were other places where they recognized Jehovah.
That is an interesting idea. In that specific interpretation, yes, that's what you conclude. But if you're careful, if you do too much history, I'm not recommending you do this. Dig too deep, which you can do by accident. You learn a little bit more about the Canaanite territory and what they thought. So this is just for your personal reference. This is not a theological belief, just for reference. And your terms is that God Most High is El Yon. That is a Hebrew or is a God or the high God, God Most High, the God Most High, or Most High God, or Most High Strength. That is also the name of a Canaanite pagan god. Note Hebrew, like the word Adonai, takes what vernacular that is commonly used, language they exist, and use that as their reference point talking to people who are not Jewish. So, for example, if I came to you and you had never, ever, ever heard the word or God's name or the reference of the term God, the word G-O-D or L-O-R-D, never heard before, have no clue, I'm a foreign language, I've talked to you about this, how would I identify this individual to you? What is it? Am I talking about a table? Am I talking about a light bulb? What am I talking about? I say, well, yeah, what's a light bulb? what is your vernacular? Let's pretend your vernacular is some other language. And we'll say that the only vernacular you're familiar with in the same concept of a deity of some form is a pagan one. I would classify as pagan. We'll pretend I'm making this up, by the way. This is not a doctrine. All right, don't confuse. I'm making this up, all right? Okay, let's pretend you only understood the word Baal as a deity. That's the only comprehended understanding knowledge of any word you've ever heard of something that is in charge of, that's not a physical flesh but human being. What would I do to communicate with you in your language? I'd use this term and say Baal is, meaning the deity you're familiar with, is the deity I'm trying to teach you about. So I would use your word language to identify who I'm talking about. And then I would identify his name, identity of who he was, or anything like that. That's what I would do. That is a personal reference for you to know. El Yon, it was a Canaanite god. There's only a little bit known about him. And Canaanite, according to some people's belief, I can't argue this because I'm not a Canaanite at the time. There was a god in the Canaanite religion that was a creator of all things, but then he retired. And he left the whole earth in charge of all of his children gods, who then controlled everything. And they all fought and fought and fought, which we discussed with that previously already, the god of Zalfi, Baal Zephon, and various of the gods that come up in the different languages, all the, well, god of the sea, god of the mountain, god of this city, that, and they all fought until finally someone became the most important one. That is the Canaanite belief system, or at least what I've been told or understood to be. Now, I've been told via only two sources, and I'm not sure what, I'm not, the one's an encyclopedia, but that doesn't mean a whole lot. And the other one was an author that wrote a story, a historical story regarding the Phoenician gods and Canaanite gods, how they interacted prior to King David. Yes, Jeff.
Well, this brings up a very important reminder about logic and clear thinking. Correlation does not prove causation. Just because things happen to coincide and line up does not mean that one caused the other.
Right. That's an important thing to always remember. It's a very important thing not to forget. So just because he uses the same term does not necessarily mean he worships the same God. Right? I want to point that to you because look at what Abraham replied to him. Look at Abraham's words, what Abraham then said. So Abraham's the first he's called like a evangelist, so to speak. Abraham's reply, says, verse, where is it? Fled, night struck, master heaven and earth. Let's see. Okay, sorry, reply to Sodom, actually, verse 22. Abraham said to the king of Sodom, I lift up my hand to Jehovah, God of the Most High. Now, Jehovah was not the words used by Melchizedek at all. He didn't phrase a title or name to him. He used a different phrase. So in this terminology, Abram's interpretation of Melchizedek's words or response is that this El Elyon Melchizedek had said, Abram is identifying him as not Baal. Avav, hey. That's what he's... Now, I do realize the Torah says Abraham should not have known this word yet, but I'm not going to discuss that at this time today. But he's identifying this God, which you've identified as a God you believe in, you all recognize. I'm identifying him as this individual, Jehovah, depending on how you pronounce it. So Abram is identifying, he's using your God term and saying your God... I identify him as this particular one who he then addresses to Sodom, the king of Sodom. Does it make sense? So we don't know what Melchizedek actually believed at all. All we know is the words he says, and we interpret what those mean in our interpretation. We interpret them. And I told you before, I'm not going to tell you what interpretations are. I'm just going to tell you what the text says and let you interpret for yourself what you think it means. Fair enough? Yes, Larry.
I won't belabor it. It was one more thing. Right. Then how could Messiah be considered a high priest after the order of Melchizedek if he didn't...
That's our second portion, which I wrote on top of this by accident. Our second portion is what that's actually talking about, what it says. It's important the Greek words don't get mixed up because we use the term order, meaning sequential. Right, or group, and it doesn't mean that necessarily. There's actually a more accurate, because a taxi, the Greek word after, and also a kata taxi, is a copy of. That's the word would phrase, a copy of. Not as if you are following, but rather you're a duplication, you're a copy. Like, here's original, here's a copy of it. And it makes a lot, the context of Hebrews 7 makes far more sense if you realize he's the term of, it's a copy of, it makes more sense to me in my head when you use the terms and what the Greek words mean. Order is one term, but when you combine it with the what's that right word? Not a pronoun. No, it's a possessive. Anyway, there's another term for it. When you add combine together, it means instead of an order, it's like a group or a sequence. It changed from a sequence to a copy, which is similar, but they are different. Yes, Jeff.
Well, one of the things about the Hebrews 7 is it's one of the call of a Homer arguments in the letter to the Hebrews, the from light to heavy. Mm-hmm. So that's what you're seeing, the comparison going back to Melchizedek is light yes. to the heavier
heavy, exactly.
is talking about Mashiach.
Yeah, he's talking, that's his goal. To if you understand this in your scriptures, you should also see how much more significant and the details are in this in Messiah. So he's, mind you, he's arguing not to Christians. The book of Hebrews, the author is arguing to other Jews who already have the Torah well memorized, and they have the details behind them well established. He's not talking to Gentiles, because Gentiles is not in his focal point of his discussion. He's like the Jews who already have, they have Melchizedek, and they who know who he was, or basic idea behind him. He said, okay, you understand this picture. Let's see how this picture in a small scale looks on a big scale for Messiah and how the details work out. That's a lot of how the whole book Hebrews is written that way, in the form of offering sacrifices, Day of Atonement, different holidays, Messiah in general. It does, here's a small example of Torah. Here's a big example of what it looks like, a copy of it on a grander, sorry, a blown up version of it, on a grown up size. Let's continue on though, because we have to do this first before I get to those details. Psalms 99. Let's jump there real quick. Real quick. Yeah, nothing's real quick here. Psalms 99. Now, mind you, I'm going to one of like 15 different psalms to talk about similar topics. So this is not you know, the end-all, be-all. Psalm 99. Now, we're looking at focusing specifically on the idea of righteousness and the King of Peace. So, Salam. So, we're right there in peace. What do those terms mean? Now, I understand the word righteousness means, this is what peace means, but how are they connected together? So, Psalms 99, it says, Jehovah reigns, means as a king. Let the peoples tremble. He dwells between the cherubim. Let the earth be moved. Jehovah is great in Zion, and he is high above all the peoples. Let them praise your great and awesome name. He is holy. The king's strength also loves justice. You have established equity. You have executed justice and righteousness in Jacob. Exalt Jehovah our God and worship at his footstool, for he is holy. Moses and Aaron were among his priests, and Samuel among those who call upon his name. They called upon Jehovah, and he answered them. He spoke to them in the cloudy pillar. They kept his testimonies and ordinances that he gave them. You answered them, O Jehovah our God. You were to them God who forgives. Though you took vengeance on their deeds, exalt the Jehovah our God and worship at his holy hill. For Jehovah our God is holy. Now, I read that whole psalm. I wanted to focus your attention particularly upon verse 4 and 5. I read the whole psalm to get the context of it. But 4 and 5, so we're discussing God being in a reign, as in overrulership, as a king type of thing, or over control. Verse 4 says, the king's strength and also loves justice. You've established equity. You've executed justice and righteousness in Jacob. Exalt Jehovah our God and worship at his footstool, for he is holy. So what's in the case of a righteous king, what are we looking for? We're looking at a king that loves justice. So a righteous king, we have the concept, the idea of justice. Oops. Misspelled justice. We have the idea of justice. We have the idea of equity and righteousness. So equity and righteousness. Right, it's a T. So we have these components we're doing with a king or something who is a rulership. Now, we'll look at this a little bit. We're going to go through all the different verses. But also in Isaiah 41, we don't have to go there right now. But Isaiah 41, verse 21, Isaiah 41, 21, it all says, Jehovah is king of Jacob. So it says the king of Jacob, so the king of the people of Jacob is God, right? So it says God or Jehovah is king of Jacob. So we're dealing with the idea of righteousness, who's interested in righteousness, and it points out here in in verse 4, Solomon says, we've established equity, executed justice, and righteousness in Jacob. So we have both Psalms 99, verse 4, discusses the king executing these components, justice, equity, righteousness, inside of Jacob. And we also have Isaiah 41, 21 says, Jehovah is king of Jacob. So we're looking for a king of righteousness, king of peace. If a messianic term, messianic idea behind him, he's going to have these three components. He's going to be king of Jacob at the same time, because that's who he does them in Jacob. Now, this is not to mean that God isn't God of the whole world. We're not discussing that topic. We're discussing specifically king of righteousness and king of peace, the king of peace, how they're combined together. We're not done yet, though. So go to Isaiah 32. Isaiah 32 also gives us some more details about this, because I'll tell you honestly, I know what justice means, right? We know just the idea of justice. So this is unjust, correct? Well, the correct versus incorrect. Equity. What is equity? Being equal means you justice is equal, just not bias, is not blind. It's blind to very, like a rich person, poor person, an old person, young person. None of that stuff matters. It's what you do matters. So what is it? Just equity, righteousness. What's that look like? Rightness, right standing. What's that? Do I don't sound like this? Is that what it means? I don't sound like an angle. What's that skit where the guy with the big pants, he swings back and forth. You look at his pants aren't moving. Yeah, he didn't do that. A Broadway skit. Anyway, because he believed, which that's just part of a Torah portion today. But Isaiah 32 tells us something about righteousness and righteous, what it looks like. So Isaiah 32, I'm not going to read the entire chapter because the middle section discusses about correction and people who are foolish and what they do. So I'm going to read the first four verses and the last five. The middle section on the correction and how to correct people, I'll let you read that yourself. So Isaiah 32, starting in verse 1, says, behold, a king will reign in righteousness, and a prince will rule with justice. A man will be as a hiding place from the wind and a cover from the tempest, as rivers of rock in a dry place. Rivers of water in a dry place, as a shadow of a great rock in a weary land. The eyes of those who see will not be dim, and the ears of those who hear will listen. Also, the heart of the rash will understand knowledge, and the tongue of the stammerer will be ready to speak plainly. So just this first section, the first four verses, we understand that this king will reign in righteousness and prince will justice. What does that look like? Well, see, so in verse 2, it explains what it looks like. A man will be as a hiding place from the wind. What's the wind do? Have you seen a hurricane? Yes. Have you seen it on TV? I've never experienced it myself, but you've seen it. What does wind do? You were here, you're now gone. Pretty straightforward. Here, not there, right? And what does a man, he stands like a hiding place in the wind. So what does a righteous man look like then? Does the wind move him? No, it does not. So I'm going to say this king and righteous injustice, this righteous injustice doesn't move. It's fixed. That's the whole idea of he doesn't lean over, right? He doesn't bend and doesn't break. So righteous is fixed. He's a fixed thing. It doesn't flex, doesn't move around. Continuing on, it says, we'll also discuss it, a cover from a tempest, from a great storm, as rivers of water in a dry place. What's that like? What's that look like? What is a dry place compared to a wet place? Which one's alive? Which one's dead? Give you a hint. The dry place, not much grows. We call them deserts. Okay, dry place equal desert. So does desert have lots of life? Look at the Sahara Desert. Not much. However, look at the jungle. Things grow there, right? Is it wet? Yes. Lots of things grow there, lots of water. So a river in a dry place. So you bring life to that which is dead. Yes. Rainforest, the idea of a rainforest. Yeah, the forest of rain. So the idea of righteous also brings life or brings a revival to a dry place or dead place. And the shadow of a great rock in a weary land. So if you are in a desert land like the Sahara, would you like some shade? Yes, you would like shade. You would need that, like Jonah wanted shade. Exactly, perfect example. So the righteous of a person does not move. It brings life to that which is dead, and it brings shelter to difficult times, difficult storms. So let's combine these things together. So righteousness is a fixed thing. It brings life or water. I'm combining the life as a symbol of water because they're usually fairly closely associated because plants die without water, so life and water are pretty closely tied. So life slash water to a dry land, which doesn't have any. So it brings these to something that is dry. So it brings them to, or this righteous individual brings them to that which is dead or dry. Right, brings things that are dead alive. It's pretty basic, right? Seeds, everything else. And of course, it is a shelter. It points out shelter, of course, with this the whole wind, the tempest, as well as a shadow or shade in a dry area. So also brings dead light, also brings shelter from storms, as well as the wind, which is as well as the sun, the hot sun. Sun or heat. No suffering heat stroke. Let's jump to verse 16 of chapter 32. It says, we're skipping, like I mentioned before, the section about the whole, you're an idiot, you should not be an idiot anymore. Verse 16, it says, the injustice will dwell in the wilderness and righteousness remain in the fruitful field. The work of righteousness will be peace, and the effect of righteousness, quietness and assurance forever. My people will dwell in a peaceful habitation, in secure dwellings, in quiet resting places. Though hail comes down the forest and the city is brought low in humiliation. Blessed are you who sow beside all waters, who send out freely the feet of the ox and the donkey. So we have this story, the tail end of chapter 32, discusses what does righteousness look like? What did it say? We read verse 17 again. The work of righteousness will be peace. All right? The effect of righteousness is quietness and assurance forever. So I can understand justice, equity. What does righteousness look like? Peace and assurance of safety forever. So righteousness has, the whole is connected to, it looks like this word here. Righteousness results in peace. Shalom. Hence, Melchizedek, king of righteousness, king of peace. So hence we have the connected righteousness. It looks like bringing peace and security. That's what it looks like. We understand that concept as we have it defined for us here, pretty well defined multiple times in Isaiah 32. Not the only place it's defined, but we're discussing all the spots because there's other things we want to talk about today. Let's go to Isaiah 62. Isaiah 62, we talk about another section, another component, or other details, some of this information about this whole righteousness and such. Isaiah 62, starting in verses 3, it says, for Zion's sake, I will not hold my peace. And for Jerusalem's sake, I will not rest until her righteousness goes forth as brightness and her salvation as a lamp that burns. The Gentiles shall see your righteousness and all kings your glory. You will be called by a new name, with the mouth of Jehovah will name. You shall also be a crown of glory in the hand of Jehovah and a royal diadem in the hand of your God. So we have this connection of this righteousness that these individuals, the Gentiles will see your righteousness because it'll be like a lamp. Your salvation, the salvation, of course, brings you peace because you're about to be saved. You need salvation, you need peace. That's the whole process of peace. It looks like a bright thing. So this righteousness and peace, is it quiet and subdued if no one notices it? No. It's not subdued when no one notices it. It's very bright. You can see it, and the Gentiles will see your righteousness. What are they seeing? Are they seeing the guy not doing this? No. What are they seeing? You're not at war. Why aren't you fighting? Why aren't you worried? Why don't you argue and beat us up and kill everybody else like all the rest of us do it? That's what they're looking at. That's what they see. You're not fighting. You're not at war. The Gentiles notice, it's very, very obvious you're not fighting. What was Solomon known for? Wisdom and understanding. Did he go to war? No. He memorized a lot of things and things he shouldn't have done. He did a lot of anniversaries. I forgot how many, 400, 300, whatever, a lot of different wives. He did a lot of things he shouldn't have done, but he didn't go to war. He wasn't much of a fighter. He was known for using his intellect, his wisdom, his knowledge to prevent war, to prevent fighting, to prevent arguments. He was very good at it. Hence his name, Solomon. Saul. What's that word? Shlomo. I've heard the word Shlomo, Solomon, Shlomo. Oh, Shalom, right? What does his name mean? Peace. They're all connected. They're intentionally connected together. So we have Solomon at peace, known for not fighting. It was very obvious. And what did all the various kings come? And they say, wow, you're amazing. What you have a right, you're a righteous king. You people are blessed to have such a peaceful, righteous king. This is phenomenal. The Gentiles saw it. It was obvious because peace was obvious. This is not a condemnation of our current political structure. Okay, we're not discussing wars we currently go into. This is just a combination of what was happening here. Okay, let's go to Jeremiah 23. And then we're gonna end this portion of our study about the peace part, because we're going to the next portion, which discusses more about how Messiah is copied in this fashion. Because we understand these components, and we understand already so far that these components look like very peaceful things. They bring life, they bring shelter, they bring justice. Everybody's considered equal. There's no tier system. And Jehovah is the king. He establishes all of it into the nation of, or descendants thereof, Jacob. Let's go to Jeremiah 23. I went too far. Okay. Jeremiah 23, the first six verses were discussed, and we're going to move on to our next, our part two of this topic. Jeremiah 23, verses 1 through 6. Jeremiah 23, 1 through 6. Woe to the shepherd to destroy and scatter the sheep of my pasture, says Jehovah. Therefore, thus says Jehovah, God of Israel, against the shepherds who feed my people, you have scattered my flock and driven them away and not attended to them. Behold, I will attend to you for the evil of your doing, says Jehovah. We'll stop there for a minute. So he is identifying people who were in charge, who did a very, very poor job of keeping the sheep, the peace, keeping them cared for. You know, the whole water in dry places, shelter from storms, did a bad job with that. He said, I'm going to judge you on this, but let's continue on. Verse 3, but as I will gather the remnant of my flock out of the countries where I have driven them and bring them back to their folds, and they shall be fruitful and increase. I will set up shepherds over them who will feed them, and they shall fear no more, nor be dismayed, nor shall they be lacking, says Jehovah. Behold, the days are coming, says Jehovah, that I will raise to David a branch of righteousness. A king shall reign and prosper and execute judgment and righteousness in the earth. In his days, Judah will be saved and Israel will dwell safely. Now this is his name by which he will be called Jehovah, our righteousness, or Jehovah the righteous. So we have this God, or this, he's going to establish this branch from David, that the king will reign and prosper and execute all these things, justice and righteousness and the equity of the people, of course. And his identity will be Jehovah is righteous, or just much like my king is righteous. This is Jehovah is righteous. We have a parallel between my king and God, or Jehovah is righteous and is righteous. See the difference? You have two parallel statements. So if you look at the similarities, that helps you identify the parallelism. And then the differences gives you the equation. So we have in Jeremiah 23, so we have very similarities with the idea of justice and have all these combined together. We have the idea of my king and Jehovah as the same individual. Both of them doing righteous. My king is righteous, or my Jehovah is righteous. It's the same idea, the same concept. So you have my king and Jehovah as the same individual, same idea, the same identity. Does it make sense so far? So we have these ideas that this is just focusing on the concept of Melchizedek's name and the city. That's all I focused on. I didn't talk about his words. I didn't talk about the bread and the wine. I didn't talk much, at least, about Abraham's response to them, or even the tithes, or who got what to who. Just the man's name. So man's name alone, just his name, just identity, we can see there seems to be a pretty reasonable connection between Melchizedek, the king of Salem, or peace, as well as our God and his apparent Messiah, the one who's to be anointed. We have pretty strong correlation just by names alone. Now, that seems pretty obvious, but it's important to know, go through them. You're going to have similarities we have just by the name alone. I don't have time to cover everything, so I'm not going to. This is just a portion of what Melchizedek means and what he's going through. The next part is part two, which I'm going to cover, though I'm almost out of time, just for a few minutes, a few brief components, which what Larry had brought up earlier about the idea of copying or what that means, the order of. John, you had a hand up?
Talk about the book of Jasher, what it has to say about...
Not today.
Not today. It's not too much. I just didn't want to interfere with part two.
I did look that up because I was curious what it had to say. There's a lot of stories about the book of Jasher and what they wrote. And I realized the book of Jasher was written far later than the one the Torah refers to. There are two different dates they're written by. And the guy who wrote the book of Jasher had the book of Enoch open while he was writing it because they're too similar to be different. I can't swear one's older than the other one, but they're both of very, very similar in nature. So the book of Jasher, I didn't discuss about Melchizedek yet because if he ties too closely to the book of Enoch and 4th Esra and Syriac writings, it's a little bit fuzzy on intermingling of spirit worlds. And I don't do that much.
The book of Jasher, that Shem was Melchizedek.
It does say that. And I can't swear it's right or wrong, because current Jewish philosophy is Shem, the descendant of Noah, was Melchizedek, as far as biology.
Daniel, as a back up to it, in the scripture itself, I know in Joshua for sure, and I think it's in Samuel 1 or Samuel 2, we find the book of Jasher being mentioned, as of historical significance. It's not without credibility,
It's the same book. If it's the same book, that we don't know. I don't know either. We don't know. That's the question. No one knows if it's the same book or not. It could be the same book. Somebody who just slapped on the name. We don't know. Anyway, let's move on. Yes, he is correct, though. Judaism teaches Melchizedek is Shem. Identity is identity, person to person. A biological man, you can see who his dad was and... not his mom, but you can see who his dad was and discuss the details. It does say that. I don't agree or disagree. There's nothing to agree or disagree about. It's just, that's what the argument is. It could be right, it could be wrong. I don't know. I'm not agreeing or disagreeing with it. It might be, it may not be. I don't know. I do believe Melchizedek was a flesh and blood human being, which is a distinct component. I don't believe he was a spirit being. Now, I know many Christian churches do argue he was a spirit. He was Jesus. Yeah. I don't subscribe to that. I don't. I need to flesh about human being because there is tithe involved here. There is food involved here. There is wine involved here. There is blessings involved here. There's things going on. And he appears to be not some stranger. The king of Sodom says, who is that? Clearly, the king of Sodom probably knew who the guy was. It's not like I've never seen this individual before. It never existed, some strange being. I'm going to tell you, it wouldn't work. So I think Melchizedek was a real human, a real person, who was a messianic figure. A figure, that is my personal opinion, okay? So you don't have to agree with me. John, anything else before I move on?
One other little interesting thought with regard to Shem. Shem was not the eldest son of Noah. But he was the one who offered the sacrifice when they came out of the ark.
Right.
So that would indicate that he was performing the priestly functions in the family.
That comes to the book of Adam. I didn't mention the book of Adam yet. But book of Adam talks about the same thing. And the idea of Adam acted as a priest because he was the very first man, right? And then the book of Adam discusses each of the genealogy descendants of firstborn has to be a priest also, much like Adam was. Hence, the Bible records all their ages. That's the theory of the book of Adam. Now, I haven't exhaustively researched the book of Adam to know how it's right or wrong, but it is a book that argues that precise point, that when you reach Shem, he wasn't the firstborn, but he was still acting as a priest. That's all speculation. I want to talk about what the Bible says instead, okay? So let's move on. I need to erase this because I have nothing to talk about. I don't have time to cover every detail imaginable. It gets a little bit exhaustive. Okay. Part two. I will cover this as quickly as... I'm already out of time. Oh, crud. Yeah, right. 10 minutes. Okay. Okay. I'm just in a nutshell, real quick, all right? So, Psalms 110 discusses a certain component, which is where Christianity jumps up and yells and screams a lot of things. And Hebrews uses Psalms 110 in book of Hebrews 5, 6, 7, and 8, and 10, as well as chapter 12. This is this concept. I'm going to read Psalm 110. It's a short psalm, just so you know what it says. Psalms 110 says, Jehovah said to my Lord, sit at my right hand till I make your enemies your footstool. Jehovah shall send the rod of your strength out of Zion, rule in the midst of your enemies. Your people shall be volunteers in the day of your power. In the beauties of holiness from the womb in the morning, you have dew of your youth. Jehovah has sworn and will not relent. You are a priest forever according to the order of Melchizedek. The Lord is your right hand. He shall execute kings in the day of his wrath. He shall judge among the nations. He shall fill the places with dead bodies. He shall execute the heads of many countries. He shall drink of the brook by the wayside. Therefore, he shall lift up the head. So in this Psalms 110, it discusses the idea of some deity or the God of all, the creator of all things, addresses the Lord of Messiah. Now, let's reiterate it again. In Hebrews, talks about it a lot as far as this concept of it. Who is this? Who's talking? And how's this order of Melchizedek show up? As I mentioned to Larry earlier, the Greek terms, and also it's repeated here, the same phrase, according to the order of Melchizedek, the phrase means according to the pattern or the copy of. So order equals pattern or copy. That's both in Greek and in Hebrew. It's the same phrase, same terminology. It is not like the Levitical priesthood. What's the Levitical priesthood? What's the distinction between Levite versus Melchizedek priesthood version, the copy, the example? Aaron has a son who also has a son, who also has a son, generational. That's how that works. That is not the example given out of Melchizedek, even though he might be Shem, I don't know. he may be, but that's not the example given within our Torahs. In the case of his case, in the case of Melchizedek, what was so strange about him? He wasn't just like Aaron, because he was also a king. So unlike Aaron's example, or the Levite's example, so Levi... I'm using that generically because I'm grouping all Levites together, though I'm specifically talking about Aaron and Levi, the priesthood itself. Levi's example uses sons. And the son process only confines itself to priests. Now, there is no such thing as a Levite king. You can't. That's against the rules. You can't do that. All right, a priest is a priest, the kings are kings. They're separate entities. You can't be one and the same. So who are the kings? What tribe they come from? Judah. That's where they come from. Judah has the kings. Judah is not Levi. They are two separate men, two separate lines, separate identities. So priest is here. This idea of the Hebrews focus a lot on this concept of the idea of priests and the Levites and how the system is supposed to work. It's son to son to son to son to son, and they have a defined work period. So most Levites go from 30 years to 50 years. So 30 years old, you retire by 50. That's your work cycle. That's it. You have a defined lifespan. You have a beginning, 30. You have an end, 50. That's it. Now, in Book of Hebrews, it spends lots and lots of time. I won't come to Dan on time. For Hebrews 7, you can read it yourself. All the time about focusing on the idea of, well, Melchizedek didn't have a beginning. Of course, he didn't have a start at 30 years. He didn't have an end. No, he doesn't stop at 50. It doesn't record. He doesn't have the limitation. That's in the Torah. Melchizedek isn't using the Torah's example of priests at all. What's he doing? Well, his example is a combination of priests plus a king. Does a king have a defined start and end date? No, it doesn't. Have you heard of boy kings? Yeah, we've all heard of boy kings. Are boy kings any good? No, they're not. They're boys. They're children. They're not good kings. They're just children. They have advisors who actually do the real work. The boy king just says, give me the crown. I'll stand up and wave. That's all he does until his advisors, okay, now you're old enough to figure this out and now do it yourself. So boy kings don't have starts. And do they get to retire? No, they don't. They could, well, death is a retirement issue, you argue. They haven't defined end as in their retirement. So we have priests who have a start and end time, but we have kings that don't. They don't have a start and end. And we know they have, obviously, from the time of Judah, if you're looking for the biblical king, they're from the time which the first, last king dies, the firstborn son, if he's still alive, you become king. Doesn't matter if you're a baby. Doesn't matter if you're a grown old man. You're a king until you die. It just how your defining start or end doesn't matter. Just it just is until you're dead. So we have Melchizedek, which said, no, I'm going to take this portion, the priests, the idea of serving a god, and I combine that with the kings that have no start and end. So they just continue on forever. They have no defined beginning or end. He just shove them both together into a single thing. Call it king priest. That is our copy. That is our Melchizedek example. That is our messianic vision. That is the example that Melchizedek points out in his example of being pointed out to in the book of Hebrews. That our Messiah is a combination of a priest plus a king together. Not that he is Melchizedek. Not that Melchizedek was his parent, or some descendant thereof, or some spiritual, he was the spirit of Jesus, he brought in to possess the man. No. It was a copy of an example. It's just an example. So Hebrews focused a lot of attention on the example. If you look at Hebrews very closely, in particular, Hebrews 7, verse 3, which I'll do real quick, because I'm tied with all of it. Hebrews chapter 7, verse 3, which where a lot of this stuff, ideas come from. And verse 7, 3, it says, actually, the first three verses, that's not fair. Hebrews 7, the first 1, 2, and 3. I just covered that. I don't have time to cover the rest of it. For this Melchizedek, king of Salem, priest the Most High God, who met Abram returning from the slaughter of the kings and blessed him, to whom Abraham also gave a tenth part of all, first being translated king of righteousness. Now, note, first being translated means Hebrew, the Hebrew author is translating the term Melchizedek as king of righteousness. He knows full well it means my king is righteous. He's using a translation, means he's an interpretation. Say, I'm using this example so I can explain the rest of my point, the rest of this chapter. So he even says so. And of course, king of Salem meaning king of priests, verse 3. Without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made like the Son of God, remains priest continually. Say what? Wait, that makes no sense. If you read it only in English. If it says, read verse 3 again, without father, without mother, without genealogy, stop. How many characters in your Bible do not list their father or their mother? Many, most, okay? Most don't list father or mother. It says, having neither beginning of days to end of life. Now in English, that means he was always there, or he lives forever. No. It's saying it doesn't record the so-and-so was 55 years old when he gave birth to Melchizedek, who then lived X number of years, who had this number of children at this age. It doesn't record that. That's what it's talking about. He did, unlike the S genealogies, Shem, Ham, or not Ham, but Shem and Noah and Methuselah, we have the beginnings, we have the dates, the times, all their life, we have the details. Having neither beginning of days, end of life, but made like the Son of God, remains a priest continually. All that stating in the first section that father and mother means he doesn't have it. He's not by genealogy. Meaning Melchizedek was an example of someone who did not inherit the throne or not the priesthood / throne through a genealogy. I mean, regardless of what his dad was. Unlike Aaron and all of their descendants had to be like their genealogy. If you're not Levite, you get the boot. I'm not discussing the paid Levitical priesthood that happens in the New Testament time. We're just, that's, you know, the highest bidder gets it. We're not discussing corruption and bribery. We're just in a normal sequence of events. Without father, but having neither beginning or end of days and of life. I mean, he doesn't record how old he was when he started and when he ended. It doesn't matter. Hence, the estimate or belief that Shem could be it. It could be. We don't know. It doesn't record it. Having been made like the copy of, made a copy of the Son of Man who remains a priest continually. It's not saying Melchizedek was a priest continually. It's saying he's made a copy of the Son of Man who is a priest continually. All right? So we have this example that Melchizedek didn't have a beginning and end. The example in your Torah, the small portion, is being blown up to a large scale of Messiah who doesn't have a beginning and end. But more importantly, is a priest continually. So Messiah is one who's referring to in verse 3, not Melchizedek. It gets confusing if you're not looking at the words carefully. So he's referring to this section that Melchizedek, spell it right, E-L-E-K, that's hard in Hebrew, is how it sounds. It sounds a lot of other things. Melchizedek. It's not that he was a priest continually, that the Son of Man, Son of God was a priest continually. Because we already know Melchizedek isn't around. He wasn't around when Jesus was walking the earth and said, hey, shake your hand, nice to see you again. It didn't happen that way. He was long since dead. So wasn't Melchizedek was a priest, but he's a copy for a larger scale version of Son of Man, Son of God, who was not by biological inheritance the descendant of Levi, but rather biological inheritance instead of Judah, but remains a priest continually. So God, Messiah didn't pop up on the scene. He's born. Oh, here's our priest. No. Didn't work that way. He earned that position. How did he earn it? He died. He did something the priest had to do. That's how you earn the job, and only God can give that job away. So, Son of God, but he was by right a descendant of King David. That's why, so biology-wise, he should be on the king's side. But because of his actions, he inherited or completed or was brought together as a priest of God in the same grouping, much like Melchizedek was a priest and a king combo. Does that make sense? Hopefully explains who the guy was, who Melchizedek was, the symbol behind him. I didn't have time to cover all the details. It's just his name and just his the office he held. Yes, Larry.
So the priests now in his loins became, did this, were giving a tithe to, I don't understand that part of it.
That's a whole other point. I can't cover all that. I'm sorry. There is the idea behind it, the concept behind it was that if we use this terminology that Melchizedek was a copy of the Son of God, which was, God was a copy of him, a blown up version of it. So even though Abraham offered tithes, and that's debatable, I'm not going to argue whether it's right or wrong, offered tithes to Melchizedek, it's no different than Abraham offering tithes to a Son of God. It's the same idea behind it, that someone who is lesser than you or not you, you are offering to them. Yes, Jeff.
Yeah, because it's an extension of this talking about after the order and the pattern of Melchizedek. Because the point that is being made is that you have a continual priesthood that continues on, this one after this pattern, versus if you were to just solely go by whether Levi and specifically the family of Aharon was officiating, then it would be kind of like a light switch on the ministry of God. Every time the temple is in operation, the light switch is on. And when the temple is not in operation, the light switch is off. So this is emphasizing that, hey, you have it actually being from the greater ministry, the greater thing that's happening in the world, to the, you could say, the one that happens in a specific place in a specific time with the Aaronic priesthood.
A good comparison, yeah.
So thus, we are like, okay, well, everything must pass through the Aaronic priesthood. But in what you're looking at here with Avram coming to Melchizedek, you're seeing that, God's, you know, open sign is still on, yeah. even if you don't have the Mishkan there, the tabernacle is not there, the temple's not there yet, but we say God's kingdom is still in business.
And that's an important point to remember, because how, when was the last time temple offerings were done? Roughly 2,000 years ago. What about all those poor people who have sinned since? Yeah. I can't offer anything. I could go out in the backyard and do it. Of course, that's breaking the Torah. Oops, another sin against me. No, exactly. If look, he's using the example of Melchizedek was a copy, or so a messianic figure of a copy of a larger scale version. Now, in Melchizedek's case, he did not inherit the right, use the term loosely, by the Torah's example, right, to receive tithes or offerings of anything. But yet he still received, it appears to be, from Abraham a tithe of some form, the tenth of something, I'm not sure what it was of, but it was tenth of something. He still received it, though the Torah does not say he should, but Abraham treated him as if he should. So in their case, since we're using that concept of a copy, Melchizedek was a copy, as a priest copy, we're ignoring his king copy section, just for the priest copy idea alone. So priest copy alone, he got a copy of the Son of God, he's supposed to be a copy of in the priest's function. So Son of God in the form of a priest only. He would then, in that same theory, be part of receiving of a tithe or offering to him. And of course, we already know the two tests what says what your tithes are. They're your praises, they're your celebrations, those are what your tithes are, the things you give. Majestic. Seems less majestic. As far as what I'm... Okay.
It just seems like he should have been worshiping Jehovah because of all this stuff.
Melchizedek should have been. He may have been. We don't
know.
Yeah,
I can see your point.
We don't know. It's debatable. That's a point. I didn't want to put an interpretation inside of what the man was and what belief he, just by what he says. You can't determine enough by what he says to identify him. I do realize, I'm not poo-pooing this point. The New Testament authors and dominantly Christianity has run with Melchizedek's image and the ideas of God from him and taken him as far as they possibly can run with him. And I don't discount that. Not that it's right or wrong. It's just what they've done. And they could be dead right or dead wrong. I don't know. I don't really care. The point is, your text only gives you an example of Messiah is the one that is the true king-priest combo. And Melchizedek was just an example of what Messiah figure would look like. There's a priest-king combination. That's the idea that we're getting through here, through this idea. He was just an example, a messianic figure, and it gets bigger, larger scale for the whole globe, not just for Levi's one line. Otherwise, we'd all have to travel to Jerusalem every couple months or so and offer our offerings if it was still stuck to Levi's line alone, because they can't have a second temple. Jeff.
Well, one of the things that might be helpful is to think in Hebrews is saying that, you know, God has done things like this before. And one of the things that you'll see is, could someone act as a king and a priest? And you
Which
might
is
say,
the argument. That's the
yes, that's
Can
the argument.
You do that?
Can you do that?
Is that
well,
the Torah or not?
And he basically brings out this example and says, he's already done that
yeah, he's already
in
done
the
that.
Past.
That's the point.
But that was just a guy.
Right.
How much more if the Son of Man is in the role of a priest and a king? Mm-hmm. Wow. What would that be?
It could actually be because you can argue very, very plainly. If I was a Jewish man at the time, I could argue, stand right in the author of Hebrews' face as, you're breaking the Torah by arguing this. You cannot combine a priest and a king as one. Can't happen. That's against God's law. Be off with you. I could walk away justly. And the other person I argued against, the author of Hebrews, would say, you're right. We can't break the Torah and combine both sections together. But because the example was given Melchizedek ahead of time, the author of Hebrews say, wait a minute. God already gave us an example of this precise thing. And you argue against me saying, yes, you can combine them together under a certain condition. And what is that condition? In this case, is what the Messiah did with the offering, what he did that what a priest couldn't actually do. He offered beyond what the priests could do and earned or received that position. That's basically you're dealing with two sides, two people, two groups of arguing. Jews say Jesus cannot be that. And the author of Hebrews saying, yes, he can. And this is the example we're given. And using this example citation, we can say, okay, with this example, I can argue within the Torah, you have proof, it can happen. And even Abraham acknowledges that it can happen. And if that's possible, Abraham, which every Jew would say, yes, he's our father. If our own father did that, who was far greater than me as an ordinary Jewish man, if he, who is superior to me, recognized a priest-king combination, and that priest-king combination was superior to him, as he offered tithes, it says the lesser to the greater, the greater blesses the lesser. Of the blessing process, I can see that in this example, Melchizedek and Abraham's relationship, that I, as a Jew who would say, Messiah, you cannot combine the two, you can't combine them, I would be proven wrong. Therefore, my own argument to saying it's a breaking the Torah falls flat and falls apart. The author of Hebrews then proves the Torah supports it. It is possible to do. All the author of Hebrews then has to do is just prove how did he earn the priesthood, because he already had the kingship. How did he earn the priesthood? Of course, he goes through the entire book of Hebrews discussing that precise thing. Does that make sense? You're dealing with two people arguing about a particular Torah point. And if either side wins, if the Jewish side wins, our Christianity falls apart. We're done. All of our sins, last 2,000 years, are still on our heads. But if the book of Hebrews author wins and proves it, the Christianity does stand. It doesn't fall apart. And rather, Judaism has to have a day of reckoning saying, okay, what do I do about this? Because they don't have a temple, right? And neither do we. We both have this issue of no temple anymore. So you have to say, how do we grapple with this problem? Does it make sense? So these are combined issues within inside the first century territory of the book of Hebrews author versus Judaism and a lack of a temple. And how do we deal with this problem? Which is what they're dealing with. How do you deal with this problem? There's no temple. So how do you offer sacrifices? How do you have a priesthood? How do you have a kingship? What happens? What do you do? And that's what these examples is what's giving with this argument. We can see that's how it's being proven. The Messiah can do this. It is possible to have a single individual who's not even alive anymore combine into both and be one, which is hard to argue. It's a really hard thing to argue that. But that's what Hebrews is doing. He's doing a very decent job arguing it through examples and points. Yes, Barbara.
Okay, just because I don't have enough background, but like, so when, you know, when you're saying we don't have the temple anymore, what, I'm kind of lost in the chronological. So when did that happen? Right before Melchizedek, or?
So the temple, chronology of history. Messiah's around, the temple is in the second temple period. So it had been burned to the ground, destroyed, and rebuilt. Messiah's around, he's alive, he can see it. But 70 AD thereabouts, which is about, some argue, 30 to 40 years after Messiah dies, the temple is burned and destroyed again. Well, the book of Hebrews now pops in the scenes. Okay, temple's gone. What do we do? How do we write this? How do we handle the scenario? The apostles are all still alive, or most of them are. They're all still alive because they're living through this experience. And okay, now we have this. Temple's gone. Rome hates us. We're all condemned to die. Many of us are condemned to die. What do we do with these problems? How do we handle this? And so we have a copy of the book of Hebrews that was addressing that particular problem. How do you handle this? So the temple's been gone for nearly 2,000 years now. But that's, so we have this political situation going on within Roman and the Greek, so the Greek way versus the Jewish way of living and things, and we won't discuss all the rebellious stuff, but that the scenario is happening. They're discussing this topic of a Messiah king combo as well as with priest in order to make this work. And how does this work? How can someone depend on such things without proving it? And he uses the book of Hebrews to prove you can do it through the Torah in the example of Melchizedek. Larry.
I'm sorry. I keep things. This to me looks like another big argument with my friends about
Oh, dear.
But at any rate, wasn't Paul... Paul was killed by Nero, wasn't he? And that was before the temple was destroyed. And so we're looking at Hebrews. When was Hebrews written?
That debated. They debated when it's written. Somewhere between... It's been argued at two different dates. I believe the last argument I had read was between 50 AD and 80 AD, somewhere in that ballpark.
Was destroyed, and that's why they're talking about this?
That was because if 70 AD the temple was wiped out, and if it was written 10 years later, because between 50 to 80, the 10-year part. Oh, that's assuming, we're careful. Christianity assigned the book of Hebrews to Paul. Christianity assigned the book of Hebrews to Paul.
Yeah.
Paul did not assign the book of Hebrews to himself. So if I write a book and say, Larry Cates, author, and hand it out to me, I assigned you as the author of my book. You didn't write the book. I assigned you as the author. So no one knows who wrote the book of Hebrews. If it was written after he died, he clearly didn't write it. If it before he died, maybe he did. The reason we don't know is simply because the book of Hebrews is written different than all of the rest of Paul's writings. And different enough. Yeah, different enough.
He didn't introduce it the way he normally does.
It's not just that. It's whoever wrote the book of Hebrews is intimately familiar with the inner workings of the priesthood and how it works and how it was supposed to function. That would not be the Apostle Paul. He was not a Levite. He was a Benjamin. So the likelihood of him knowing the inner workings of how Levites work, how the Levitical system was supposed to work, and how the temple worked, is lesser than one who was a Levite. So it's been argued that whoever wrote the Hebrews knew more than Paul knew. Hence, it's an argument. And as a result, it doesn't matter.
What I meant was, how do we know we're assigning the book of Hebrews to have been written after the temple?
Likely it was written after, at least for the tail end of the temple's existence. Yes.
There's one statement in there that has some indications that it's in that realm of either it's during the rebellions where Rome is starting to close in and destroy it, because it makes a comment in there when it's saying these things are fading away.
Yeah.
So the question is the temple in the rearview mirror, or are you like seeing the destruction coming up right in front of you?
Right, exactly. Hence it's the tail end. We're not sure. It's a ballpark of a range. Paul probably didn't write it, but no. Any question, comments? I took you over time. I apologize for half an hour. Yes, John.
I have a good summary point, I think. And you have some really good points, Daniel. Yeah. One, you pointed out the deficiency in Judaism without the new covenant, the new covenant and the whole New Testament, really, if you want to call it by something different. But I came from a church group that taught that in the resurrection, some people will be priests and some people will be kings, you see,
which is
total heresy to me. And it's right here in Revelation 20 and a few other places as well. But let me read it because it sums up your point in so many ways. Blessed and holy is the one who has a part in the first resurrection. In the first resurrection. Over these, the second death has no power, but they will be priests of God and of Christ, and they will reign with him for 1,000 years. Mm-hmm. That's what's coming up.
Yeah, there we have. Yes, I'm familiar with the same tradition you came from. I'm familiar with the same tradition that you came from. I was taught similarly that they are separate, and I can't swear that everybody is identical. I don't think they are, but if there's a combination there that's going on. Any other questions or comments? I apologize to you over time. We'll close with a prayer. Almighty God, a great Heavenly Father, thank you for this Shabbat day of rest, a day of the study and learning and worshiping, Father. Please help us to do what is right and open our eyes to see. It's really good to see. But help us understand. We trust you and ask you will bless us that we see what you've done, the great power you've done through your priest, your king, our king. Father, help us to worship you according to your ways and not our own. We ask you to bless us and keep our eyes and ears open to your ways. And Father, that we share with one another the great things you've done for us in our lives with one another. They help each other and give each other hope. But we ask you to bless the rest of our Shabbat in Yeshua's name. Amen.
You've been listening to a discussion at Hallel Fellowship. If you would like to hear more discussions or if you have any questions, visit the website at hallel.info. That's H-A-L-L-E-L.info. Hallel.info.